Blog Talk Radio.
Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in Washington, D.C., on a glorious, beautiful, little chilly day here in our nation's capital. If it's Tuesday, that means our usual roundtable of political insiders and political pundits are with us. So we'll start the introductions. We've got a lot to get to, a lot of it based on the First Congress Society, an organization you've heard us talk about many, many times here on the air. But before we do that, let's go around the table and introduce our roundtable. First, he is the former parliamentarian for how many Republican National Conventions? Three National Conventions of the Republican Party. He is the former vice president of the National Broadcasting Company for Government Affairs. He is a longtime insider in Washington politics. He is the Honorable Bob Hines. Bob, welcome back.
Glad to be here, Justin. It is a beautiful day.
It is a gorgeous day. He is the vice president of the Eurasia Center. He is the head of their China Business Development Program. He is a lawyer. He is bar certified in Washington, D.C. and the great state of New York. He is our international affairs expert. He is Dr. Ralph Winnie. Ralph, welcome back.
Thank you. Glad to be here. I'm Justin Niswold de Fei Chong Hao.
Okay, again, you lost me at the first word, and I can't even pronounce that. So.
You do an excellent job.
Oh, thank you. That's very kind. Wow, that's in Chinese. That's Mandarin?
Mandarin,
nice,
yeah.
Nice.
Yes.
He is currently a grad. I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, if you believe that's what he said, Justin, I'm surprised.
No, it's all about
let me live my dream. Let me live my dream. He is the former staffer for the Department of Homeland Security's White House Liaison's Office. He is currently a master's degree candidate at American University. He is the executive producer of Backroom Politics and the executive director of the First Congress Society. He is Mr. Perry Blasting. Perry, welcome back.
Thanks, Justin.
I'm your moderator, JT Russell, and we have a lot to get to. I want to start off today. And by the way, before I get started, we urge anybody who's listening out there in Radio Land to please call in. Join us here on Backroom Politics. I'm sure we're going to be talking about something that's going to hit a nerve with somebody. But if you'd like to ask us questions, make comments, just anything political, anything inside, outside the Beltway, you can call us at 619-638-8477. Again, that is 619-638-8477 to call into Backroom Politics. We're going to start off swinging for the fences today. I've got to tell you, I watched Meet the Press this past Sunday, as I do most every Sunday. And while I was watching Meet the Press, I saw Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann of Minnesota in an interview with the moderator of Meet the Press, David Gregory. I keep wanting to see Tim Russert. It's just old habit, hard to die. God bless him. David Gregory held the Congresswoman's feet to the fire, kept asking her very tough questions. But I will tell you, the most disturbing thing I found is the fact that members of Congress, particularly in this case, Congresswoman Bachmann, has a very short memory of several months ago of the recent coming together, let's all be civil to each other. Congresswoman Bachmann has accused in public and openly the Obama administration of being a corrupt government. She has referred to the president and his administration as a gangster government. I'm going to digress for a second and I want to talk a little bit about the First Congress Society and what this radio show and how it relates to the First Congress Society. For those of you who are interested, and if you go to www.firstcongress.org, you'll get an idea of what this organization is that we're talking about. But the First Congress Society started off as a group of people here at Shelley's Back Room coming together every Tuesday, talking politics, but we had one thing in common, that politics has to be civil, there has to be statesmanship, there has to be some sort of respect and equality in the way that this country is governed and the way that we have civil debate. When it gets venomous, when it becomes demagoguery, when it becomes almost to the point of hateful, is when we downgrade the institution of Congress, downgrade the institution of this great experiment of ours in the U.S. government, and it defies all practical purpose in getting things done, not only here in Washington, but the state and local levels as well. Bob, we've talked about this many times before. You know why we started this endeavor in First Congress Society, and even this radio show was started largely as a part of that. What's your view on, you know, why we started this real quickly? And then we'll get into the heart of the issue with this Michelle Bachmann situation.
Well, Jason, you said it accurately. The original construct, if you will, for the First Congress Society was a few people sitting in Shelley's, having a cigar, having a drink, and talking about issues of the day, and bemoaning so much of the discussion, or the lack of discussion on Capitol Hill, and so much the antagonism, the unwillingness to find solutions, more dogmatic thought and think than actually trying to solve problems. And as we sat around and talked, the concept of the First Congress Society sort of osmosed out of those discussions. And over the last year, we have had at least more than, we've talked to at a number of universities to political science classes about the need for civility in government. This radio program is an outshoot of that. And it's unfortunate that we're not having any influence.
Well, you know, and the one thing about it is, you know, when we talk about it, you know, again, I need to give a shout out to our other regular who is not here. He is somewhere south of the border enjoying the last few days of his vacation. Congressman Al Swift is enjoying a long deserved rest. And what we'd like to do is call out the fact that Bob, you and I and Ralph are, in fact, Republicans. I am more moderate than most. Some call me a Democrat. That's fine. But I'm very much a New England Republican. You are very much a Rust Belt Republican yourself. Ralph, you have a whole different perspective on your views as it relates to international affairs. And Al Swift is a known liberal Democrat and former member of Congress. The fact that we could sit here and have, and we've had some really good discussions about the politics at hand, but it's never become uncivil. And the fact that we can do this here over drinks and over cigars defies the fact that they can't do it just 10 blocks that way up on Capitol Hill. And that brings us to our current situation. That brings us to the situation of Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann. When you look at what she said and the fact that she will not, it came out the other day on Politico that Michelle Bachmann said, and I quote, "I don't take back my statement on gangster government. Quote, I think there are actions taken by this government are corrupt." Bob, that I have not seen that kind of demagoguery in a long time. I mean, we're talking Glenn Beck demagoguery here. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, it's always, it's always easy to make statements like that in the spur of the moment. But it seems that Congresswoman Bachmann, when she's had an opportunity to say what she's really, what she want, you know, any change that she wants to make in her statement, seems not to want to have made any changes. And calling a government corrupt is a serious charge. I mean, I don't know what evidence, if any, that she has. I would certainly hope that she didn't just make that comment off the top of her head. If it's true, you know, I'd like to know what she means by that. Corruption is in government is about the most serious charge you can make.
And unfortunately, it's an open invitation for another crazy to try and assassinate a politician or even Obama.
Well, outside of that, yeah. Outside of that, just the bottom line aspect of the demagoguery that's coming out of, and let's be honest, it's not, you know, we're just focusing on Congresswoman Bachman because she happened to have the most glaring statements of demagoguery out there. Perry, you were going to make a comment about this.
Yeah, she's specifically focusing on it. It's about $105, $106 billion that were, I don't want to say allocated, but that were kind of talked about in the health care bill. And what she's essentially claiming is that members of Congress were not told about the true reason why this money was going where it was going. And, you know, you said earlier that David Gregory kind of held her feet to the fire, but I would argue that while he did so, he didn't ask the follow-up questions that needed to be asked.
What were the follow-up questions that needed to be asked?
He allowed her to make these statements, but then he never said, show me where in this bill that you've had for almost a year it actually, you know, diverts funds illegally, which is what she was basically accusing Obama of doing, was not notifying members of Congress and kind of just going out there and doing things on his own, which clearly, if you know how politics works, you know, it doesn't actually work that way. He can't write checks from the Treasury and nobody knows about it.
Bob, I mean, you've been involved in leadership in Congress before, both on the majority and on the minority side. As a member of, as a staffer for leadership, would leadership in previous members of Congress, would leadership allow this to happen? In the old days, I always got the idea that somebody would have stepped in at this point and said, whoa, time out.
Well, I'm not so sure about that.
Really?
I don't know that. Obviously, there's a need to understand precisely what she is saying. And this, I have not been aware. I did not see Meet the Press on Sunday. But it sounds as though she is saying that there are some hidden provisions in the bill that permit some funds to be moved around. I don't know enough about it to talk about it in specifics.
Right.
But I do know this, that the fact, you know, unless there's some reasonable evidence to indicate that Ms. Bachman is right, I would hope that someone would ask her, you know, exactly what her information is and what proof she has of any corruption in the government. That's a very serious charge, and I don't know whether it's true or not, but I'm certainly surprised to hear a member of Congress say that.
Exactly. Well, Ralph,
she needs to attack the merits of the bill rather than attack Barack Obama and his administration as being a gangster government.
I mean, she's done everything right, except call him outright a criminal.
Right.
And that's
not helping the situation at all.
Right.
People together.
Perry.
And the phrase that she used, I'm looking at another news article. This one's from Yahoo News, titled "Bachman Exposes." The exposes is in quotes, $105 billion, and again in quotes, fraud in healthcare law. What she's saying is that the Obama administration, Pelosi and Harry Reid, deceptively hid more than $105 billion in health care appropriations in the budget. And she's claiming that no member of Congress knew that this $105 billion of funding was contained in the budget in health care reform appropriations. And this phrase she keeps using is legislative fraud. I would argue that she is essentially calling him a criminal. When you accuse somebody of fraud, you know, that's what that is, and she doesn't go on to explain what exactly she's talking about. She just continues to say, oh, they were deceptive in their practices, and, you know, the money will be spent unless we pull it back.
Go ahead, Bob.
Well, if that's her quote, it strikes me that her problem is with the Democratic leadership in the Congress rather than the administration. If she's alleging that they hid the money in the bill, I don't know that that means that the administration had anything to do with it. Knowing of the interest in the Democratic leadership to get as much as they could in the bill, I'm sure that there are any number of provisions that were put in that with less than full knowledge of people. I'm sure it was a large bill. It was, I think, it was 2,000 pages.
Yeah,
it was a large bill, and it was a bill that had. That had a variety of bills in pieces moving back and forth, and at the last minute they were putting things together, and I am sure that a lot of people didn't know every provision in that bill, and I'm not so sure that that means, and as fast as it was moving, and as late as it was moving, I am sure that it would have been possible for Democratic leadership to slide something into the bill if they wished to.
Well, you
but
know,
that's a different thing. That's happened all the time. Yeah, but that's I wouldn't exactly call it SOP, but it is not a unique situation.
Right. I mean, I can't tell you the number of times that I've seen legislation go to the floor of either the House or the Senate where there have been, quote unquote, hidden monies appropriated as part, whether you want to call them earmarks, whether you want to call them add-ons, amendments, however. The bottom line is, that's not unusual. What she's talking about is something that apparently has been done for hundreds of years, but now the fact that she has a stage, it now calls out the question of, well, what they did was deceptive, it was fraudulent, it was criminal. And that's a problem.
Yeah, well, before we decide that she has gotten off base, I'd like to know the specific language in the bill and exactly what it does, and I don't know that.
Right.
So it's hard to tell.
But I go back to even if we did, and I, like you, Bob, I have not seen the exact language that she's talking about.
Yeah.
But even if we did know the exact language, does it justify her remarks, not just once, but many times in public venues?
Well, it seems to me that, again, speaking as someone who does not know exactly what the situation is, her language would indicate that she believes that it is a dirty trick, more than a dirty trick. It is a serious, it's a serious event that calls into question the integrity of the congressional leadership and the integrity of the White House, and that's a serious, serious situation.
And there are venues that, you know, instead of calling it out, I still go back to, and one of the questions that I've heard of recent is, we haven't heard a lot from Speaker Boehner on this particular issue. He hasn't really come out and said, hey, back off, but he hasn't really come out and said, well, she may be right. It's been almost a little too quiet. Are we reading too much into that, or
yes,
is that we are?
Yes. I think the speaker has a lot more important problems to deal with than one member of his caucus, his conference. There are two votes we'll talk about later in the Senate today with respect to the continuing resolution and what it will look like and how long it will be. And I know that he is up to his neck in those negotiations. And those matters are matters of serious, serious budgetary requirements. And I'm sure that he's more tied into that than he is with one member state. He can't keep up with 270 people.
It's going to be interesting whether the Democrats call Boehner out on this, because Boehner has repeatedly said that he has trying to instill the high moral standards and ethics among all of his troops. To uphold a very high standard of civility and decorum.
Right. Perry?
That being said, this isn't a random Republican outlier. This is Michelle Bachmann, who gave, you know, the third-party response to the State of the Union. This isn't just someone who randomly showed up on Meet the Press who happens to be a little-known member of Congress. People know Michelle Bachmann. People know what she stands for. It's a little bit harder for him to control someone like her, whereas, you know, a freshman member who might have, you know, an outside view.
Well, I have to believe, and we're going to continue this discussion. We're coming up on the break. We're going to continue the discussion regarding this, but I have to believe that when even though it's kind of expected, she's obviously taking a leadership role with the Tea Party. And that's going to be another topic we're going to bring up here shortly after the break. But she's the one getting the FaceTime. She's the one getting the headlines. She's the one who's kind of become the voice of, quote-unquote, the party, as opposed to the people that we would, the more civil people that we would look towards. Obviously, Speaker Boehner, a great statesman of our time. We look at people like Tim Pawlenty, Mitt Romney, those who are getting ready to gear up for 2012, and even other leaders inside, you know, Congressman Chairman Ryan from Wisconsin, who you'd think would be right there when we're talking about the budget, when we're talking about the fiscal crisis. Instead of focusing on this, I would like to see some voice. Those aren't the people we're seeing out in front. Who's getting the headlines is Michelle Bachmann. We're coming up on the break here. It's 20 past the hour here on the East Coast, 20 past the hour actually everywhere.
just which hour.
Yeah, exactly. It's random as to which hour we're in. This is Backroom Politics Live from Shelley's Back Room on Blog Talk Radio. Stay with us. Bob Hines, Dr. Ralph Winnie, somewhere Perry Blasting's doing executive producer type stuff. I'm your moderator and host, JT Russell. We're going to continue on the discussion, which leads us into, we talked about the $105 billion elsewhere, but the other issue and the interesting point that came up in our discussion was today the Senate had two very interesting votes before them today. For those of you who are joining us from last week's discussion, we were on the verge of a government shutdown last Tuesday, and all indications were that it would probably be a government shutdown was inevitable. As is the case with politics inside Washington, D.C., it is always subject to change. It's like the weather in Florida. If you don't like it, wait a second, it will change. We got a reprieve from a government shutdown a 2-week reprieve. The continuing resolution, instead of stopping last Friday, the 4th of March, now goes an additional 2 weeks to the 18th of March. But the two votes, Bob, tell us a little bit about what were the two votes that came before the Senate today, and why are they critical telltale signs of what's going on?
Justin, the two votes are the two competing proposals for what the continuing resolution should look like going forward. And I think that the House has a provision, as we all know, we talked about it last week. They passed a continuing resolution for the proposal would be for the rest of the year, and it would cut $61 billion out of the budget, mostly out of discretionary, what we call discretionary spending, which are all the programs and projects and things that the government does,
right,
except for the entitlements, you know, school lunches and books and support for police officers or teachers or you name it. That's what it is. The Senate, on the other hand, has a resolution which would provide only for $6.5 billion in cuts. And again, these are proposals that the president has already made that would be legitimate. He's moving them forward into this current year's budget rather than saving them. These were in his original proposal for next year's budget, for the budget year that begins October 1. Now, in the Senate, they're going to vote on these two proposals today. Neither one of them are going to get enough votes to pass muster.
Right.
Now, the significance of that is, and it's early now in the two-week period that we've got for the continuing resolution that is currently in place, that gives the Congress about 10 or 12 days, to get their act together and figure out a resolution that both the Republican House and the Democratic Senate to agree on. Now, if they don't and do another shorter, they can do another short term again if they make any progress. But we are in a situation that is a very difficult situation if you are a government agency.
Right.
How do you operate?
Right.
How do you know how much money you have? How much money do you know you're going to have? How do you do things? It screws everything up not to be able to have your budget in front of you and you know what your dollars are.
Right.
And right now, we are on a continuing resolution, which means that the monies that were at the level of last year, the monies they're working with. And that causes a problem. So right now, we've got about, when these two votes are taken this afternoon, and both resolutions will fail of the majority of the votes they need to pass muster with the other body. The fact of the matter is that we're going to be right back where we started months and months and months ago. What's the budget going to be for the current fiscal year?
Right. And yet without any certainty, the government's ability to operate on a normal daily basis, everybody's scared to, other than your daily operational budgets, to make new investments in technology upgrades. They're scared to make investments into new programs because nobody knows whether or not they're going to have that money to spend if they allocate it.
That's exactly right.
So with this in mind, the Senate's now got, I mean, for lack of a better term, the ball's in the Senate's court, per se. The House has already sent the bill over to the Senate floor,
the House
versions.
No, the Senate version has not been at the House.
Right.
Now, the Senate version, they're going to try to pass theirs but they won't get enough votes to move it over. You'll get 50 or 52 votes, something like that, which they have to have. That can't pass the House.
Right.
They know it can't pass the House. And if it won't pass the Senate with 60 votes, both resolutions will in effect die on the Senate floor as a practical matter, because neither one can pass both houses.
Can Harry Reid, do you think Harry Reid has enough stroke and leadership to get people to maybe cross the aisle?
No.
Really?
This is a vote. This is a test vote to show both sides that neither side can win with the resolution they want. They're both going to have to go back to the table, sit down, and start cutting deals. It's as simple as that. And it's a very hard thing to do because the House of Representatives number is so much different at 60-some billion,
right,
as opposed to $6.5 billion. That the number is so huge that it's going to be a very difficult thing to get a deal done.
Well, on top of that, on top of just the partisan side, the Republican versus Democratic side, we still, in order to cut deals, it's almost like the deals have to be cut with a pseudo third party, i.e. the Tea Party covenants inside of the House. So they're going to have their own particular views on how this is going to go down. I mean, this is probably, in my opinion, and Bob, you've been in this town a lot more than I have, a lot longer than I have, this is the most awkward, I think, I've seen in the budget discussions at this late stage in recent history.
It's been a long time since we've had as big a problem as we have on this, and the two sides are as far apart as they are.
Right. Does the feeling on the Hill, is, are you getting the vibe that they just don't understand that in some instances political careers are at stake and that something's going to have to give? Who possibly could come out as the one person to help drive this to conclusion?
Well, I don't think there is any one person who can do that.
Is there a group of members or a group of insiders that could possibly drive this thing to solution?
Well, I don't want to talk about the effort in the Senate going on privately among senators on both sides of the aisle, but they're working for the future. They're not working for this problem.
Right.
But there is a group working in the Senate very diligently right now. But the problem is the here and the now. We have 12 days. A week from Friday, is it a week from Friday
week
or Saturday?
Friday, correct.
A week from Friday or Saturday, we have to have something or the government shuts down. And right now, we have, on the one hand, we have a resolution that says we'll cut $6.5 billion. On another hand, we have a resolution that goes, I think, $61 billion. That's such a wide chasm. It's pretty hard to see how they can get their act together unless both sides are willing to give up a substantial amount, the Senate to take a much bigger cut and the House to take a much less cut.
Is that realistic?
I don't know. I honestly don't know at this stage.
I think you're going to have to look at certain senators that are up for re-election, like Claire McCaskill, who's been known to cross party lines on certain issues. Watch to see what she comes up with in terms of a potential compromise.
Perry?
And I think it's a lot about, for people who don't necessarily follow this and understand fully what's happening, it's a lot about not just the dollar value of the difference, but the programs that are attached to those dollar values and what the difference is, what that actually amounts to in real speak, not just dollar values. You know, Harry Reid earlier was talking on the floor about things that are going to get cut, one of those being, the arts and humanities. And he mentioned a program that very few people even know exists, which is a gathering of, I forget what it's called, but it's in his home district, and it's about basically cowboy culture every year in January that receives federal funding as an arts and humanities project, where they talk about cowboy poetry and the cowboy lifestyle. And he mentioned this, and a lot of people kind of reacted with, well, who cares? What is this about? Well, to each individual member of Congress, some of these programs matter a lot to them and their constituents. And it adds up to, as you said, a very large difference.
Well, I mean, you know, unfortunately, when we deal with situations and something that we advocate, you know, compromise is never easy. If compromise was easy, we would have a perfect Congress, we wouldn't have these discussions, and we'd have perfect civility. That's a dream world. That's fantasy land. The reality is there is a give and take. There has to be compromise. It is going to hurt you in some instances, but it doesn't have to be as painful as literally a government shutdown could possibly be. When we look at the vote and the telltale signs, knowing that it's not going to go through the House, knowing that it's going to pretty much die on the floor, it's got no life support system at all, do you envision possibly a scenario where this entire fiscal year is done on continuing resolution without resolving this problem going into what is now going into the late second and beginning third quarters of the fiscal year?
Well, any continuing resolution that can pass obviously is going to have some degree of cuts. Now, we've already had a resolution for extension for this two-week period that cut $4 billion out. The president is already is taking another $6.5 billion from, I guess, his proposals for the next year's budget and moving it forward into this year's budget. I don't know how many more cuts the administration is willing to make. Every time they do it, somebody loses a program they care about.
Right.
And we're talking about, you know, school programs and teacher programs and safety programs and, you know, all kinds of things. And again, all kinds of programs like the cowboy history stuff. I mean, there are those things exist because senators want them and congressmen want them.
Right.
And there's going to be an awful lot of people in both parties who are having things cut out that they put in to the budget.
I mean, credit to the President Obama and credit to the administration, they actually put forward a budget that they went to the Hill and said, look, let's be clear, I'm not real thrilled about this, but you know what? We've all got skin in this game.
Yeah.
We're all going to have to take a beat down for some of this. Well, here's my version of my beat down.
Yeah.
And yet we still see the traditional partisan politics getting involved. And, you know, it's funny because when you look at Senator Rick Santorum, you know, he was quoted in Iowa the other day, which I don't know if you want to call this an opening bid for him to possibly run in 2012 or not.
It is.
But, you know, the lessons here in 2011, he's saying, this is not 1995. The lessons we're learning now don't even equate to 1995. Do you agree with that?
I'm not sure what he means by it. I mean, what we did learn in 95 is that if we go to a closure of the government, the Congress gets more painfully attacked than the administration does. The president has the bully pulpit. The president is in charge. And if he goes on the air and says, well, the government has been closed down and the Congress won't pass a resolution, and the reason is because the Republicans in the House won't agree, then the Republicans are probably going to have more pain from the voters than are the Democrats, because the president usually has the bully pulpit,
right.
And he speaks with one voice.
But now we, you know, going back to the comments that Senator Santorum made in Iowa this week, his comment, and I quote, I think we're in a better atmosphere to pick a fight and draw a line, citing that in 95, it was hurtful to the GOP, that the GOP took a beating, but they still held a majority, but it was a slight margin at that point. But he's saying now that the Republican Party has the upper hand in this, and now's the time to draw a line in the sand and hold firm. Shutdown or no shutdown?
Well, that certainly appeals to the Tea Party Republicans and a lot of conservatives. It appeals because everybody knows we've got to start cutting someplace, and now is the time to cut because we have a continuing resolution. It's an opportunity to cut. So we should take advantage of it. And I'm sure that appeals to a great many people. The question is how much? And I think that probably, I think myself that we're going to get a solution to this. You can't not have something going forward that authorizes the departments of the government to spend money.
Right. They have to spend money to operate.
They have to operate. I mean, they there's no way you can just say, we throw our hands up, we can't agree. They're going to have to find an agreement.
The bottom line is there are going to be a lot of worthwhile programs that are going to have to be cut.
Yeah.
They just cannot afford
to
keep every program.
It's unfortunate. There are solid programs, and there's solid programs on the Republican side as well as on the Democratic side that are going to take a hit for this. But unfortunately, I go back to the original statement, is, you know, unfortunately, compromise is not easy. Compromise is something that hurts. Don't like it, but you got to do it. We're coming up on 20 minutes till the hour, top of the hour. We're going to take another 2-minute break here. Stay with us. This is Backroom Politics live from Shelley's Back Room on Blog Talk Radio. jacket, downtown Washington, D.C., 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital. This is Backroom Politics, live from Shelley's Back Room, the place to be, as Bob likes to say. It is the premier cigar tavern, and I also want to give a shout-out to our friends over at RSDC Group, who has been underwriting Backroom Politics for the past month. Ryan Denmark and his crew providing a lot of government consulting solutions for the IT sector. If you're joining us from our last segment, we were talking about the continuing fiscal crisis here in Washington, something that is spurning a lot of emotional rhetoric on both sides. It's striking a nerve with a lot of people inside and outside the Beltway. It seems to be continuing fodder for the White House, for them to maintain a strong positioning for 2012. And we're starting to see a lot of new players coming out, starting to get a little bit more vocal, a little bit out there on the Republican side for the 2012 slate for the Republican nomination. But let's talk a little bit about the vote that just happened today. For those of you who are just joining us, we're talking about two votes that were on the Senate floor that neither one of them have a chance of passing. The Republican one, which has $60 billion in cuts, the Democratic version, which has $6.5 billion in cuts. Neither one of them are going to pass the House successfully, which means that we're going to go down to the wire for another possible aversion of a government shutdown. When we talk about what's going on, in order for any budget to continue on in our current fiscal state, it's going to require a raising of the debt ceiling. There's just no way around it. Or am I misreading that, Bob?
Not at all.
So with that being the case, with there being a continuation of funding levels at current state versus our debt ceiling level, we're really close to the ceiling. How do we avoid those two coming together and getting no ceiling, just busting through the glass, Bob?
Well, let's face it. If we can't get ourselves a budget that we can all live with out of Congress and not down to the White House, it strikes me that we're going to have an equal amount of problem getting a vote to increase the debt ceiling. There are a number of members of the House of Representatives who have said that they're not going to vote for a debt ceiling increase unless they get substantial cuts in the current budget year.
Right.
Now, there is no fixed date on which you have to vote on the debt ceiling. There is no target date you must do it. However, you know, there are things that the Treasury can do to push the date back a little bit and give us more working room. But the truth of the matter is, you can only go so far with that. I mean, as Ralph knows, we've got tons and tons of debt held by foreign banks and sovereign funds and the rest of it. And those we just can't, in effect, default. We just can't do it.
Well, if we vote to raise the debt ceiling, I mean, that puts us in a very compromising position internationally.
Yeah.
I mean, and certainly it becomes a national security interest if China, Russia, and other countries are controlling our debt.
With that being brought up, does the president's nomination of former Secretary Locke, does that send a message to the Chinese government of, hey, we mean business? Him being the former Secretary of Commerce, does Secretary Locke have anything to do with that?
Well,
positioning into China,
He'll certainly have some influence. The key is getting our fiscal situation in order. The fact that we don't have a budget makes the Chinese and other countries very, very worried. If we raise the debt ceiling, it's going to make us look like we do not have control over our own monetary system. It will make the dollar weaker, and other currencies which are tied to the dollar are going to be affected.
Well, we've heard rumors about a possible issue of a lot of the countries that tie their currency to the dollar jumping ship and going to possibly the euro,
right.
Which would obviously just continue a free fall of the value of the dollar.
Right.
You know, I said it a couple weeks ago. I was recently in Canada. I go to Canada, and all of a sudden the Canadian dollar is stronger than the U.S. dollar. When I get less Canadian money from my American money, that's got to send a message. I've never seen that before.
Well, you know, I guess we were talking a moment ago about we could maybe make the euro good currency. They've got their own problems with half, you know, there are three or four countries that they're trying to bail out right now. Can you imagine the ripple effect throughout the world if we didn't raise our debt ceiling? It would just be astonishingly horrible.
So how do members of Congress turn around and either rectify or come to some sort of solution in their mind that this is a reality? We can't, you know, we're really playing with dangerously close to the proverbial economic third rail. How do they reconcile that in their mind, and how do you get that message back to the constituents? What is the message you get back to the constituents?
Well, I don't know what the constituents. I don't think there are 1% of the country who are thinking about this issue. Now, they will be if we can't raise the debt ceiling, because there are going to be all kind of ramifications. But Ralph has it right. We're going to be in a hell of a fix if we can't get ourselves our financial world in some stability. And a lot of it depends right now on the House of Representatives and the influx of a number of new members, many of them who had not served in the legislature before and are not accustomed to the give and take of negotiations in their everyday life. And that makes it somewhat difficult.
And the bottom line for these other countries is economics. And are you a debtor country, or are you a country that's on the move that is going to create jobs and economic opportunities for your own?
But there's a lot of jockeying for position in that discussion that you talk about. That are you a debtor nation, or are you an up and comer? We've seen traditional debtor nations, i.e., Brazil, who had a horrible economy 10 years ago, now all of a sudden in the Western Hemisphere, they're a leading market. You look at India. India is a true economic power. Like it or not, they are. So we're starting to see a lot of changing, a lot more, that the idea of the global economy is truly coming into its own right now, unlike any time in the past that we've ever seen. Am I wrong in that?
Education is very, very important. We're among industrial nations. We lag way behind in reading and math.
Technology, science.
Absolutely.
I want to go back to a comment that Bob made earlier about, you know, basically the 1% of Americans don't understand the impact of this debt ceiling that we hear about. Number one, real quick, Bob, just a layman's version of what is the debt ceiling that we talk about?
The debt ceiling is the amount of debt that the Treasury is legally permitted to take on to finance everything that goes on. That, you know, just everything that government
basically
does.
One large credit card.
Yeah. That's about it. It's the big credit card.
Okay.
And it has to have its, if you continue the analogy with a credit card, we are in the process of trying to get our amount of credit available to us up.
So basically we're close to maxing out on that line
of
credit. Eventually that card's going to get declined.
Yeah.
And we're getting to a point where we're going to have to increase the limit on that card.
Yeah.
But I want to go back to the point you made that 1% of the people just don't understand the ramifications. I want to turn this over to Perry. Perry, you spent a lot of time at an American university, fine institution. We love the folks up there. Shout-outs to Professor Crouch and the crew up there at AU. When we talk about the 1%, in your experience and spending the time that you do on campus, do you find that this is a subject that is completely oblivious to, especially in the political science circles that you hang out with, but in the general populace of the student body, do they see this? Do they understand this? Do they realize the impact? Or is it just something that I want to watch Real Housewives?
Hey, that's an idea.
I want to find out what Charlie Sheen's tweeting.
You know, it's an interesting point, and it's one that certainly comes up in discussions that we're constantly reminded. You know, I graduated from American with my undergrad. I'm currently there for grad school. And it comes up often where either a student or professor says, we have to remember in this conversation that we are not general America. Most Americans don't go that far into an institution of higher learning where they're getting advanced degrees or having the conversation about politics. Even within that circle, we're in the minority of the population. So think about how few people get their master's in political science. Even in that program, most people know generally what's going on, but really couldn't speak for more than 30 seconds about it. And it's not something that's looked down on or that's unusual, but if you're not an econ minor, or you don't really follow it because you're personally interested in it, you're more concerned about the general, elevator discussion about politics, that people have their level of interest in either foreign affairs or the party that they affiliate themselves with. Most people, most undergraduate students or graduate students can't go in depth into the economy. And again, we're talking about an institution that is in the top 10 programs in the country for that in Washington, D.C.
I mean, let's be honest. Econ's not exactly a sexy issue to bring up.
Known as the dismal science for good reason.
No disrespect to our members and listeners who might be CPAs or economists out there. Here in the smoke-encrusted nerve center of Backroom Politics, on the big screen above us in our studio, breaking news out of Libya. Apparently, Libyan President Muammar Gaddafi is in the hotel where the government has put a majority of the Western journalists, and they are waiting for him to speak to the journalists. We'll keep monitoring that. We'll give you updates throughout the rest of the show in the last hour of what's going on. We're going to talk about the Libyan crisis here after the top of the hour break. But going back to the economy, Perry, you bring up a good discussion, and going back to Bob's quote of it is the dismal science. Why, knowing the fact that this has direct impact on how these students are going to be governed in the future. I mean, it's the difference between having entitlement or not entitlement, having a stable Social Security system or not, having a stable Medicare system or not. That calling into question, is there a reason why we don't see more of the type of student body that we would see, for example, at a program like AU, becoming more informed about this type of situation?
My personal opinion is that we don't talk about it enough because we don't need to. It's not every, there's always legislation going on, but it's not every few months where we're talking about the government shutting down or a budget crisis or the debt ceiling. These topics don't come up, and most of the time they don't need to come up. When, for instance, when we're in a legislative affairs class and we're talking about passing legislation and what it takes to, to do that, sure, we talk about how you have to get things funded. But it's rare that what we see going on today is talked about because the situation is rare. So people aren't as interested in it, and people aren't talking about it as much. And when it does come up, people pay attention. But let's be honest, once it's handled, it's going to go away again. People are going to be more concerned with the topic of the day. Not many people are going to be thinking about 2, 3, 4 years from now, are we going to have it again? Now, those people are thinking about it, but we're not talking about it in a lot of the classes. We're not talking about it. Programs such as this, 3, 4 weeks ago, we weren't having this conversation. We're having it because it's the topic of the day.
Right. And it has direct, it's now becoming more prevalent in the day-to-day discussions because of the impact it's going to have.
The issue of the debt ceiling comes up about, every third year maybe.
Right.
It depends on how rapidly our debt is growing.
And for a couple of weeks or maybe a month or two at a time.
Yeah. That's right. I mean, so it's not the kind of an issue that that comes up very often. And it has absolutely no impact on the average citizen unless the whole thing disintegrates. And
it's an abstract concept, but we have to get our fiscal situation under control.
It's something we have to do, and we usually do it without nearly having quite as much difficulty as we're going to have this year.
Right. Thank you, Perry.
And Ralph brings up a really interesting point, which is that it is an abstract concept. Most people, if you were to talk to a lot of people and say, hey, have you heard about the government shutting down? They go, what do you mean? We're a superpower. we have billions and billions and trillions of dollars. How could a government shut down? How could you just stop? It doesn't work like that.
Well,
and,
you know,
and we don't explain it because it's so rare.
It is. I mean, it is rare. I mean, you know, to support Senator Santorum's comments in Iowa, the fact that, you know, 95 is exactly, he is correct. 95 is a different situation than we have today in 2011. The implications on just the general public are the same. It's just politically the tables are a little bit skewed or a little bit turned, if you will, in whether it's in favor of the Democrats or in favor of the Republicans is arguable. But when we talk about the overall fiscal stability, Bob, looking into, and again, being in layman's terms, when you look into your crystal ball and you look down the future, do you see, and I know this is a question I've asked before, is do you see any winners coming out of this current fiscal situation on the Hill? Not individually, but groups or programs or...
I don't know that you're going to see, you know, avoiding an iceberg by the captain of the ship is not something we all cheer him on about and say, aren't you a great captain because you avoided an iceberg? You're supposed to be able to avoid an iceberg. You know, that's your job. And if we solve the budget problems and get the national debt increased with, to whatever number the administration wants, I don't think we're going to see a whole lot of people around the country standing up when their congressman walks into the room and they all start clapping because we didn't hit an iceberg.
Right.
They're not supposed to hit iceberg.
Good analogy.
American
you're invoking the Titanic analogy. That's impressive. I never would have gone there, Bob. I like that. We're at the top of the hour, and for those of you who are out there in Radioland, we invite you to call in. The number here is 619-638-8477. Again, that is 619-638-8477. If you'd like to dial in and ask our roundtable any questions regarding the debt ceiling, the fiscal crisis that we're dealing with here in Washington, or any of the political issues of the day, please feel free to call in. We'll get you on live with the roundtable. Ralph, back to your comment.
I forgot.
I got to give out. It's top of the hour. I got to give out the phone number. Sorry. And our executive producer is saying it's break time. We're going to take a 2-minute break here. This is Backroom Politics live from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital on Blog Talk Radio. Stay with us. Thank you. we're back. We're live here in Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital. It is 5 minutes past the top of the hour, Eastern Time, West Coast Time, Hawaii Time. It is Backroom Politics live from Shelley's Back Room. With us, as always, our usual roundtable of political pundits that come here every Tuesday, the Smoke Cigars, talk about politics, everything inside the Beltway, outside the Beltway, state, local, and federal. With us today, as always, he is the Honorable Bob Hines. Bob, thanks for joining us again.
Always glad to be the best place in town.
That's right. Dr. Ralph Winnie, thanks for joining us, as always.
Glad to be here.
Our executive producer and executive director of the First Congress Society and just overall professional student is Mr. Perry Blasting. Perry, thanks for joining us again.
I think I need another degree.
Don't we all?
Exactly. And I'm your host and moderator, J.T. Russell, and here's what's going on. We were talking the last segment, if you were joining us from the top of the hour, we were talking about the fiscal crisis, talking about the debt ceiling and the votes that happened in the Senate. Continues to baffle the mind as far as how can we possibly come to some sort of resolution in the fiscal crisis on the Hill. It is divided unlike any time we've seen it divided before. A solution does not seem imminent. And there's got to be active discussions going along, but they might as well be across the Pacific Ocean. That's how far apart they are. But if you join us before the break, Dr. Winnie had a comment. Yeah. He forgot it, and so we're going to go back to Dr. Ralph Winnie. What was your comment?
Well, actually, I was preparing for our Libyan segment.
Oh,
I didn't actually
Nice segue, Dr. Ralph. Nice segue. Always good.
But the American people have elected these members of Congress to get things done, and they're going to be very angry and upset if we have a government shutdown. The bottom line is it's going to have to be some sort of compromise. At the end of the day, I think it'll happen.
I mean, we're literally seeing, we just had Senator John Ensign of Nevada announced this week, within the past 48 hours, that he's retiring. Yeah. That makes it, what, number 12?
It's going to be an open field.
That's our 12th senator or 12th major member in leadership who has decided to come down out of political office. It's making 2012 and the subsequent elections very, very interesting.
Yes.
I mean, our radio show is going to be fantastic next year. We'll have thousands and thousands of listeners. When we talk about the fact that we're holding now members of Congress and the elected officials here in Washington their feet to the fire, and also at the state level. I mean, I got word back from friends of mine who were out in Wisconsin, friends of mine who were out in Ohio, as far as what was happening in their state budget crises.
Yeah.
We have the governor of the great state of Wisconsin continuing to hold tough. We're now finding out that the Democratic senators that are being held at a Motel 6 somewhere south in Illinois, they're now debating about going back to Madison. There may be a deal imminent, but the labor unions are going to fight them. This is a real serious situation. Talking about that for a second, when we look at what happened in the state crisis, and Ohio's not completely out of the mix either. Your home state is very much doing a Wisconsin maneuver when it comes to repealing collective bargaining. Does the state legislators in the governor's office, do they understand the fact that they're poking a very big sleeping bear in taking collective bargaining out and going after the unions? Bob, what's going on?
I think they understand completely, but they're trying to, in effect, get a better management hold on the expenditures of the state. And one of the major expenditures of any state is the cost of government, and they're trying to, almost every pension fund seems to be underfunded, all the healthcare funds seem to be underfunded. I mean, by big numbers. I mean, it's California's underfunded by $25 billion. That's a country's debt almost. And every state seems to have some depth of problem, except maybe for a half dozen.
Well, you know what's funny is, we talk about this now that to go on the record in equal time. As a Republican, I have friends who are active in some of the big unions here in town. I am not exactly gung-ho, but I support some of the union labor and labor's initiatives. They do good things. That being said, you know, we also see the story that was published in the Washington Post today about one former city manager in a small industrial town outside of L.A. His pension is $15,000 a month, $500,000 a year in pension he gets because he had a deal, you know, because he was doing six different jobs. His high five came out to be $180,000 a year, $300,000 a year. And now he's getting $500,000 out of CalPENS, which is the California Pension Fund. Does that not give credibility to Governor Walker and the governor in Ohio?
Sure.
Does that not give them reason and fodder?
Yeah, it does indeed. And I suspect you can find. I think California has didn't California we see something a couple of years ago, a smaller community, they were paid something like $800,000 to their mayor.
Yes.
I mean, things like that are just. They're unconscionable.
And the entire
and
the entire city council in that town was also indicted for funneling $5.6 million into their own pocket.
Yeah. Right.
And they were paying for, you know, dance clubs and golf outings, et cetera. It's cost doing business with the city government.
But the bottom line is the states cannot afford to keep paying out these pensions. And Governor Walker is moving closer to drawing a line in the sand. Either he's going to compromise with the unions, or he's just going to fire.
But that's a dangerous. That's dangerous. I mean,
it's dangerous because he's already energized the labor movement.
Numbers are going to skyrocket. I mean, if you are not a member of a union and you are a government worker, I'll tell you what. If you're making, you know, $19 an hour as a government worker, guess what? Where do I sign that union dues card? Because I'm joining because they're the ones that are going to have the voice and the muscle. I can't do it individually.
Yep.
So now the question comes back is, is Governor Walker possibly resigning the fact he could be the quickest governor's term in Wisconsin history? They're already gunning for him. They have to be already gunning for him in 3.5 years. And he's not even done with his first 3 months.
No. There's no doubt that he's going to be right in the gun sight. Well, it's a bad expression. But he is going to be in their sights for get him out of office. I would not be surprised if the unions didn't start a petition to impeach him or something.
But the bottom line is if he can balance the budget and cut
if he
create jobs, then he's going to get reelected.
Sure.
You know. You look at traditionally when you look at the recall of Gray Davis out in California. Mm-hmm. You know, largely fiscal.
Yeah.
I mean, there are people that have arguably said that that Gray Davis wasn't necessarily a bad governor. He just got caught up in financial issues that, quite frankly, was the downfall of his political career.
Well, the problem with unions in the public arena is because it isn't a the government is in effect paying itself.
Right.
And there isn't the same kind of arm's length negotiation that you have in private enterprise.
Right.
And I would you can see that it's an incestuous relationship. You know, even at the best of times.
Correct.
Even if you try to make sure it's an arm's length relationship, it never is.
You know, we've seen the quote unquote radical unions such as AFSCME and SEIU really take a stand and just become militant about what's happening out in Wisconsin and Ohio. We've seen some of your more traditional, more conservative union movements still get pretty active out there in those venues. I mean, their voice is going to be heard. I mean, make no mistake about it, is those organizations have a lot of money to get their voice and their positions heard, and they will be heard. And I just don't know if I want to be on the opposite end of that rope when we're playing tug of war.
Yeah, well, you know, I certainly agree with that. But just think about one thing. Think about the teacher union. The teachers' union's contracts all say last in, first out. So if there's any cuts, who are you cutting? The bright young people who all want to be teachers. And the people who are doing it by rote and have been been doing it for 30 years are basically the ones you keep. So you're cutting off your nose to spite your face. You're not keeping the best people who ought to be kept. You're keeping the old people who ought to be put out the pasture. That's a reality. That's a reality, and that's the problem with having the public unions, in effect, because the teachers union is probably the best example of a union that isn't doing the best for their constituency, which is the kids.
And they're, right.
They're not. That's a fact. They're not.
And they're against things like merit pay and school choice.
Well, we have also seen. I got to tell you something. With Al not here, it's hard being a Democrat at the table. I've been trying to be equal time to everybody. This is hard.
And I wish Al was here too, because then I would really let go.
Well, Justin, we're all going to kiss you after the show.
Let's not say that. I'm going to handshake. Fine. But I will tell you this. We've seen. I absolutely agree with you when we talk about the AFT, the American Federation of Teachers, and the Teachers Union. When we talk about that, but we've seen examples of where the state union leadership have gone to the table. We saw it reluctantly in New Jersey. We've seen it in other states like Massachusetts, where they have made concessions and said, okay, you know what, maybe we do have to pay a little bit more. Maybe we do have to go to performance-based evaluation criteria as far as who stays, who goes. The fact that we are losing the youngest, there's literally no incentive for young people to go into the public education system, because the guy who's 78 years old who just refuses to retire, drawing a paycheck and is handing out and sleeping at his desk, he's the one that's going to get tenure. He's the one who's going to be doing the work when budgets get tight. Absolutely agree with you. But AFT is an example where we've seen different factions in those unions coming to the table, arguably, and making those concessions. At a national level, we just don't see it. And that's a bad, bad message you got there. And I think that detracts the credibility of the AFT, quite frankly.
Well, why can't it be done at the national level?
I can't speak for the AFT. I'm neither a dues-paying union of the AFT, nor am I part of the AFT leadership.
But if we could theorize what...
We can all look in the crystal ball. My personal opinion, as the humble moderator... Did you save it? Okay. My executive director of First Congress Society and the executive producer of First Congress Society actually just was right in time. This is why you're going to get an A in this class.
I know, saving you from getting tickets, calling down the cops.
And by the way, for those of you who are listening inside of D.C., I know I have a lot of outstanding tickets. That boot is not that far away. But thank you for doing that.
You know several good lawyers to help you.
I do.
No one is above the boot here. Marriott Jaguar just had that last week.
I know. I actually have a friend of mine who is an officer with Metropolitan Police Department, was parked outside his precinct office and was booted. And he had his police gear in. He had his police jacket in the car. They still booted him. That's a whole other story. That shows the fiscal crisis that we're dealing with here inside even the government of Washington D.C. When we look at the concessions that are having to be made. Why can't they do that nationally? It would make sense, and their credibility goes up when they at least make certain concessions. If they're looked at as being just a brick Great Wall of China, not going to move, that takes away from their credibility. It takes away their credibility to attack, for lack of a better term, or to at least challenge the issues of the whether it's the governor's mansion or the state legislature or the opposition. You can't bring a knife to that gunfight, for lack of a better term, not getting uncivil, but just an analogy. You cannot go to that argument saying, well, we absolutely stand this point. That's the bottom line.
If they were to compromise, they're standing
if they compromise, then, look, let's be honest. perception is reality in this game and in this town. The perception of you guys are going to be stalwarts against, there's nothing you can do, doesn't help your situation or your position. Am I wrong in that, Bob?
You're not wrong at all. Exactly.
So when we talk about that, and by the way, the room here in our studio is starting to get filled. It's going to be we've got an audience here for Backroom Politics. And we also invite you to call in our last segment. The number is 619-638-8477. Again, 619-638-8477. This is Backroom Politics live from Shelley's Back Room. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit of international affairs. We're going to talk about the Libyan situation. That's a slippery slope, kid. Stay with us. We'll be back in 2 minutes. In our political roundtable. This is Backroom Politics live from Shelley's Back Room. Joining us as always, Bob Hines, Ralph Winnie, Perry Blassie, and myself, J.T. Russell. We're going to talk about the situation in Libya continues to create more disturbing headlines out of that part of the world. The instability in the Middle East is obviously very prevalent, very visible. But what we're seeing now is we're seeing a more defiant Muammar Gaddafi trying to maintain power inside Libya. The latest that we're seeing on CNN right now is that reportedly President Gaddafi is inside a hotel in Tripoli. There's a possibility he will be addressing Western journalists on the current situation. We have seen the government of Libya bomb their own people. They had airstrikes today against rebel encampments at the large oil ports inside Libya. The humanitarian crisis on the western border between Tunisia and Libya continues to grow. It's caused a lot of concern inside the UN High Commission for Refugees, as well as the UN General Council. And by the way, when we talk about the Libyan situation, we've heard Chief of Staff Daley this weekend on Meet the Press talk about the situation of possibly creating a no-fly zone. We also saw Senator Kerry talking about the possibility of a no-fly zone over Libya. That is cause for a lot of slippery slope discussions here in Washington. Bob, the one idea that everybody's talked about is it seems like an easy fix. We go in there, we create a no-fly zone. But in order to do that, as Secretary Gates has eloquently put, it's not that simple. We have to go in there. We have to attack and destroy their anti-missile, anti-aircraft encampments. We have to go in there. We have to bomb their runways at their major airports and air bases. That's basically an act of war. Do you think the United States right now is in a situation where we could commit to that kind of international enforcement?
Not by ourselves.
How so?
Well, I think that, as an example, I think before anybody ought to think about doing something like that from the outside, I think you have to consider the United Nations ought to be, deciding what they want to do. The European Union should be doing the same thing. The Arab League has got to be willing to say, yes, he's killing his own people. We have to stop it. How do we do it? I don't think there's any chance at all of the United States, and there shouldn't be, the United States deciding to go in there and do something on their own. I think it has to be, in one respect, a worldwide revulsion at the fact that he's got hired mercenaries coming in, he's killing his own people, he's bombing his own people. He is proving that he will do anything he has to do, no matter how heinous it is, in order to keep his job.
Rob, why haven't we seen a more aggressive stance by the UN General Council and the UN Security Council in addressing this situation? The General Council and the Security Council, everybody's been waiting for some sort of enforcement resolution to come out, but New York's been kind of quiet.
I think part of it is Libya had a lot of clout with their oil. There were a lot of countries doing business in Libya, and people were very afraid of what would happen with Gaddafi gone. Would that mean that our economic interests are going to suffer? And I think there's a lot of uncertainty coming out of Congress. You have a lot of prominent people calling for some sort of intervention, but Secretary Gaines is against intervention because he's unsure whether the U.S. would be welcome if we went in. And also the issue of who would the U.S. work with? Gaddafi has done a very good job of keeping the opposition weak, divided, and off balance, and he stemmed the tide of defection.
There's no question that Libya is a major supplier of oil to a country which really doesn't need it, in Russia.
Right.
You have President Medvedev just really being ostensibly, hands-off on the situation as a whole. Do you foresee somebody like President Medvedev getting actively engaged in becoming part of the solution of the Libyan crisis? Or would he possibly stand up and join a unified endeavor to enforce a no-fly zone resolution out of the UN?
Well, Medvedev has to make sure that the solution is going to benefit Russia, both economic and political, in Libya. Remember, for the past 30 years, the Russian government has had a very, very close working relationship with Gaddafi. And it could be disadvantageous for Russia to have someone other than Gaddafi in power, purely from an economic standpoint. So the Russians are going to be very careful about supporting any resolution that would undermine Gaddafi.
Bob, the American public as a whole views military action by the U.S. as just a U.S.-led coalition, a U.S. military force. Do you see Congress and the general electorate supporting an enforcement endeavor being done by either NATO or by the UN with active American military support, or Is that something that's just unacceptable in our view?
I would think that if there was a, and I get back to my idea of almost a worldwide revulsion, if everybody, if every, most every country in the world decided that this was just a terrible thing, and we were all going to join hands and do it together, that's one thing. But us doing it, short of that kind of broad support, I don't see.
Absolutely, I agree. Because if we take the assumption that the Libyan people should do it on their own, we're assuming that the opposition is winning and is in control. The problem is Gaddafi has been very effective in taking the opposition off their game and dividing them.
Exactly. And he's using military force. You know, he's got airplanes and he's got helicopter gunships. He's got all kinds of weapons that you can use. And there's almost nothing that the rebels have that can they can protect them, much less defend themselves against that kind of an attack. And unless something happens, I think relatively quickly. He may very well stay around a while. I don't know what he's going to say today. I'd be awfully surprised if he said, I'm going someplace else, I'm quitting. I'd be very surprised at that.
The U.S. will try, obviously, and fund the opposition, but it's going to be very, very difficult and problematic.
Yeah, it is. I mean, we don't have any good relationships over there with anybody in Libya. We haven't had a relationship with them for years.
Barry?
Right now, one of the best defenses that the people have had against those helicopter gunships and against the fighter jets has simply been the individuals who are flying them refusing to bomb their own people. And that's not a great defense.
So if that's the case, and again, we're now fighting a war on two fronts, mind you. With the two-front war, we're possibly creating a third front. We've already stretched the American military to its ultimate limit. Do we really have the infrastructure to support that as a leader versus just an active player in a more international effort? Does it make sense, especially with our current fiscal crisis, does it make sense to allow somebody like NATO to run with this?
It would be great if we could get NATO in to enforce the no-fly and a no-tank zone. At this point, there still is a tremendous amount of opposition among many countries as to what the best approach to dealing with Gaddafi is. That said, Russia and China and other countries have strong economic interests. I think the best approach is for countries to try and encourage more defection within Gaddafi to the other side. Right now, Gaddafi seems to stem the flow of defections. If you can start pushing for more and more defection, you'll see Gaddafi's power weakening. You also have to make it very clear that these paramilitary groups are going to be held accountable in the International Criminal Court for any actions that they take against civilians. And you're going to have to make it clear to Gaddafi that he will be severely punished for killing his own people.
Well, when we talk about Muammar Gaddafi, breaking news out of CNN right now is apparently Muammar Gaddafi has left the hotel with the journalists and will not be speaking to the Western press corps, which is amazing. One could read it one of two ways. He's either running scared or he's that confident he's got enough international support to keep him in power that he doesn't have to say anything. Perry, you look like you...
It begs the question, what was he doing there? If he didn't intend to ever address the journalist, he was he just making an appearance for the sake of an appearance?
Very possibly. Let's be honest. I mean, anybody who thinks that they can try and shadow Muammar Gaddafi's train of thought is living in a dream world. This guy's like Charlie Sheen right now. I mean, there's
your man.
That's awesome.
Yeah. I guess I look at it as this. He has burned so many bridges in the way he has dealt with his own population. He's treated so many bridges. I think that there's only two options for him. Either he wins or he's dead. One or the other.
Well, I mean, there was rumors flying around today in some of the wire reports that he was actually actively pursuing a deal to have him bow out gracefully, and whether he ends up in another, like a Uganda or something like that, is questionable. But apparently that has been defunct. Doesn't look like we're any closer to a situation. Perry.
Well, the opposition groups came out and said that they denied those reports and said we're not working with him for any type of deal. But you got to think about that strategically. It's entirely possible they are, but it's embarrassing to have that leak if you are working on a deal. He wants to announce it on his own. He wants to save a little bit of face. At this point, it's not going to be much.
Sanctions are starting to kick in. You're seeing stronger sanctions by both China and Russia, which are good.
But arguably, the sanctions, you know, I've seen a lot of international pundits talk about, are sanctions effective? You know, do they work? You know, we've had sanctions against Iran for years. We've had an embargo against Cuba that has just been blown out of the water as far as its effectiveness. You know, do the sanctions work? Are the sanctions a viable way of putting pressure on him to leave?
Especially
in an oil-rich country like Libya.
Not by themselves, but if you have a condemnation and you have public pressure, and the international community kind of clamping down. And we're starting to see that slowly, but it's going to take a while.
Bob, what do you think? Do sanctions work? Or would they work in this situation?
I don't think, you know, sanctions usually don't, you can't turn them off and turn them on. You know, you decide to put a sanction on, it takes a while for it to bite. And so we're not talking about, you know, a few months down the road. We're talking within days and weeks at the most. This problem is going to, whatever the solution is, ultimately in Libya, is going to be settled very, very quickly.
If every country refused to accept Libyan oil, see him out.
No.
Perry, that's, you know, going back to Ralph's comment about international combination, that only works when there's no allies left. But when you bring up an example like Cuba, who's had sanctions in place for going on 60 years, they still have allies in Venezuela sometimes, and you know,
they've had Russia for a very long time. Yeah.
But you know, same thing in Iran. Even now with Libya, we can put sanctions on the next 50 years. But if we don't have a joint worldwide effort at condemnation, if it's only some countries and there's still a lot of countries to back it, it's not going to go very far.
Well, that makes sense. We're coming up on 20 minutes to the top of the hour. We're going to take another quick break. And we'll finish up with our last segment. We're going to go free-for-all on this one. Anything's open for discussion. And plus, we've got to, we're going to have to say goodbye to one of our key members, at least on the air. So we want to talk about that for a second as well. If you want to join us for our last segment, please give us a call. The number is 619-638-8477. Again, 619-638-8477. This is Backroom Politics live from Shelley's Backroom on Blog Talk Radio. Stay with us.
Thank you.
live here at Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital. This is Backroom Politics, live from Shelley's Back Room. Continuing in with our last segment, we're going to have a little fun here in our last segment. We're going to play a little game. We were talking about Muammar Gaddafi and the serious situation in Libya, but arguably some of the quotes coming out of Muammar Gaddafi mirror those quotes coming out of Charlie Sheen. And I got to tell you something. The Guardian newspaper, the major publication out of London, came out with a Charlie Sheen versus Muammar Gaddafi. Whose line is it anyway? So we're going to go through 10 questions, and we're going to come up with our general answer, and we're going to submit it and see who got it right and see how we're doing. So the question is, out of these quotes, who said it, Muammar Gaddafi or Charlie Sheen? Number one, I have defeated this earthworm with my words. Imagine what I would have done with my fire-breathing fist. Sheen or Gaddafi? Ralph?
Sheen.
Okay, collectively, the answer is Sheen. Next question, number two. Your face will melt off and your children will weep over your exploded body. Sheen or Gaddafi?
Sheen.
Sheen?
Oh, that sounds like a Tyson quote.
Well, Tyson's not an option. Sheen or Gaddafi?
Sheen.
Sheen? I'm going Gaddafi, but the majority is Sheen. Life without dignity is worthless. Sheen or Gaddafi?
Gaddafi.
Gaddafi 1, Gaddafi 2, Gaddafi 3, it is Gaddafi. I am extremely old-fashioned. I'm a nobleman. I'm chivalrous. Sheen or Gaddafi?
Gaddafi.
Gaddafi 1.
I'd say Gaddafi.
Gaddafi 2? Gaddafi 3? Gaddafi it is. That's our answer. I am like the Queen of England. Sheen or Gaddafi?
Oh, that's Sheen.
Again, the quote.
I'm looking to respond with just one.
I am like the Queen of England, Sheen or Gaddafi. While Bob's trying to get composure back,
Sheen.
Ralph, Harry,
Sheen,
Bob,
Gaddafi.
I say Gaddafi.
What are we doing about a tiebreaker?
You know what? I'm going to call this one. I'm going to take moderator privilege. I'm saying Gaddafi.
You might be right on that one.
I am much bigger than any rank. For those who are talking about rank, I am a fighter. Sheen or Gaddafi? Ralph?
Gaddafi.
Gaddafi?
Yeah.
Sheen.
Sheen. I say Gaddafi. I don't
That's
think
it's got to be about the colonel.
Yeah, I was going to say, Colonel Gaddafi, please. Every great movement begins with one man. Sheen or Gaddafi? Bob?
Gaddafi.
Barry?
Sheen.
Gaddafi. I say it's Gaddafi. These resentments, they are the rocket fuel that lives in the tip of my saber. These resentments, they are the rocket fuel that lives in the tip of my saber. Sheen or Gaddafi? Bob?
Sheen?
Gaddafi.
Gaddafi?
Gaddafi.
I don't think Sheen's capable of knowing what a saber
that's,
is.
That's exactly I'm going
Gaddafi, so we're going to answer Gaddafi. I woke up at 4 a.m. before dawn. You should be asleep. You're all tired after a sleepless night. Sheen or Gaddafi? I could go either way that way.
Yeah,
one.
I'm not.
Sheen?
Gaddafi.
Sheen? I'm saying Sheen. And the final one is, the U.S. Commission report on 9/11 was an absolute fairy tale, a complete work of fiction. Sheen or Gaddafi?
Gaddafi.
I think that one's a no-brainer. Okay. Now then, we've gone through them. We're going to submit our answers. And we scored 5 out of 10.
I want to know which ones, though, because you overruled us on a couple.
We scored 5 out of 10. Here's what we had. Number one, I defeated this earthworm with my words. Imagine what I would have done with my fire-breathing fist. We answered that correctly. Sheen. Number two, your face will melt off and your children will weep over your exploded body. Sheen. Life without dignity is worthless. It is correct. Gaddafi. I am extremely old-fashioned. I am a nobleman. I am chivalrous. We answered Sheen. It was Muammar Gaddafi.
Oh, that actually kind of makes sense with the female guard.
Okay. I am like the Queen of England. We got it right. It was Gaddafi. I am much bigger than any rank. For those who are talking about rank, I am a fighter. That was correct, Gaddafi. Every great movement begins with one man. We answered Sheen. It was Muammar Gaddafi. These resentments, they are the rocket fuel that lives in the tip of my saber. We answered Gaddafi. It was Charlie Sheen.
Wow.
Wow.
So he's replacing Tiger Blood with rocket fuel.
Rocket fuel, torpedoes of truth, and sabers.
All
right. These last ones, I cannot believe we got wrong. I woke up at 4 a.m. before dawn. You should be asleep. You are all tired after a sleepless night. We answered Charlie Sheen. It was Gaddafi. Perry's taking credit for that one. And finally, the U.S. Commission report on 9/11 was an absolute fairy tale, a complete work of fiction. We answered Gaddafi.
Wait, that was Charlie Sheen.
That was Charlie Sheen. Charlie Sheen apparently tweeted this one night after a Charlie Sheen Tiger Blood
game. I'm amazed he had enough brain to realize there was such a
thing. I'm surprised he came up with a sentence that included absolute fairy tale and work of fiction in one. So we're having a little bit of fun here. I mean, it is a serious situation, but it just goes to show you that, you know what, I don't care who you are, I don't care what your stature is in life, the social media has just created a monster as far as getting your voice and getting your opinions heard. I mean, some of these are just, just absolutely ludicrous.
The same Gaddafi doesn't have Twitter. I'd follow him.
I gotta ask. You almost want to find. I mean, by the way, Charlie Sheen's Twitter account has just exploded.
Guinness World Record.
It is a Guinness World Record for most followers ever on Twitter account.
In that time frame. Yeah.
And you gotta admit, it is a sad statement.
What does that say about
We are a nation. I weep for the future. We are a nation that will follow the train wreck. We will follow that train wreck into the guts of hell just to see. You know, it's almost like the argument that everybody had about Howard Stern. You know, why do you watch Howard Stern? Well, you want to see what he's going to say next. You don't want to miss it. Not to compare Howard Stern to Charlie Sheen or Muammar Gaddafi, completely different people, but that was the argument of why everybody watched Howard Stern. But anyways, so that just gives you an idea of the mindset of both Charlie Sheen and Muammar Gaddafi. In our last
amazingly alike.
Yeah, I mean, literally, we have
and yet so different.
Yeah. I don't know. For all we know, Gaddafi has a whole room of goddesses. I don't know.
Well, we know he does.
Oh, really? Oh, I don't want to know that.
He's got the bodyguard.
I got the female
goddess
bodyguard.
Yeah,
got a whole his. So it's changed recently because he actually needs security now.
So
but it used to be that he would train hundreds of beautiful women in martial arts, and they'd follow him around, and they were his bodyguard. He had an all-female cadre of guards.
His doctor goes with him every place, and he's a good-looking Ukrainian.
Didn't he recently, not defect, but she ended up somewhere without him, was talking a little bit.
I don't know either, but I don't know too much about it.
Well, you know,
it's not my wheelhouse.
Well, we're having a little bit of fun here. You know, we like to close out every show with a little bit of frivolity, a little bit of freelance work, and we've done that, I think. But a couple of things we also like to clear out before we finish this last segment, last 10 minutes of the show. I do want to say one thing. For the past few months, we've had a great, great asset with both the First Congress Society and Backroom Politics, this radio show. It is with a really heavy heart that we gotta say goodbye to our executive producer, Perry Blasting. At least the on-air Perry Blasting. He is going on to bigger and better things. He's actually going to have a day job somewhere, which I think arguably none of us really have. But he's going to be a productive member of society. And
which none of us are.
Yeah.
You served your time.
Yeah, I'm on his age. My God.
No, I'm better looking.
That's true. You've aged a lot more graciously than I have. Perry, I got to tell you something. A lot of the momentum that we're starting to create, not just with the radio show, but with the First Congress Society, has been largely attributed to your hard work. You've been very, very supportive. You've been an active member of this from the beginning. You've made some decisions and kind of had to, you know, rally the cats a little bit in some decisions on who's going to be on the air, who's not. You've given some direction to this radio show, as well as been a great supporter of the effort for First Congress Society. This is something that's very important to us personally. This is a personal effort. We've got a lot of skin invested in this. And for what you've done, you've really taken us to a next level.
that'll get us set up for the bigger, broader things that we're doing. I can't speak for Al, Bob, or Ralph, who are kind of the board of directors of First Congress Society, and they're the founding members of this radio show, but I will tell you, me personally, I can't thank you enough. You truly have, I mean, you're young, you're smart, you've got this political thing pretty much in your blood. There's great things that are destined for you, and the fact that you're a part of this, and will continue to be a part of it, but the fact that you've been a part of this show has truly been a great, great, great asset for us, and I cannot thank you enough. So I just wanted to say that. Bob, you want to add anything to that?
I would say just hear, hear. You have been a wonderful help, and you have done things that we needed to have done, and you know how to do them. We thank you. Couldn't be better.
And Perry stuck with us even through all the technical issues and you know, finally getting the hardwire in here. We don't have to worry about things dropping off. Standing by and watching us finally get to the effort that we're in right now where we're starting to get our groove has been really helpful. Ralph, do you want to add anything on that?
Good luck to you, buddy.
Thank you.
You're going to do well.
Thank you. I really appreciate that, guys. It means a lot to me. And I've had such a great time coming down here every week for the past, you know, 4 or 5 months and talking with you guys for 2 hours, and that's going to continue.
Well, don't be a stranger.
No, I'm still going to be running the day-to-day with First Congress, and it's just that the new position that I have doesn't allow me to come down for a couple hours every Tuesday. I'll definitely call in when I can, stop by when I can. Hopefully that'll be a lot. I just don't know.
Right.
But I see good things for the organization, for the radio show, and where it's going in the future.
Well, you know, since you are the perpetual college student, we hope that you'll continue to, you know, spread the word about the organization. We're down to 8 minutes for the show. We're going to close out our Tuesday show, and we're going to get to our section of Tell Me Something I Don't Know segment. We call it Tell Me a Story. We're going to start with you, Ralph. Tell me a story. What's something that's going to happen in Washington this week or in the coming future that nobody else knows about that we can scoop everybody on? Tell me a story.
The Obama administration has roundly criticized for not encouraging Libyans to revolt against Gaddafi. The reason is they've looked back at what happened in the first Gulf War, where Bush was encouraging them, and many of them were assassinated. Now you're going to see the Obama administration really encouraging the opposition to take up arms.
Okay. Bob, tell me a story.
I believe, and I think that it has to happen. We are going to get past our budget crisis. We are going to find a way to work it out because we have to work it out. Right now, it looks like it's impossible to get together the Republicans who are wanting so many more cuts and the Democrats who want so fewer. And on top of that, the debt ceiling fight is part of this. And I think both the debt ceiling will be increased, and I think we will solve the problem of the continuing resolution disagreement, and I think we will get an answer. It's going to be very difficult. It may not happen 10 days from now, but it is going to happen. We are going to solve the problem. And it's going to be a good education for everybody.
Wow. Perry, tell me a story.
Well, as my last tell me a story, and in keeping with my tradition of news that you will not hear anywhere else, I think now would be a good time to give Backroom Politics the scoop and announce my candidacy in the 2040 election cycle. And you're just going to have to stick around and wait to hear what office and where.
I better get a steak dinner out of that one, pal. I really do. Really do. I don't have a tell me the story this week. I'm the moderator. I can take that privilege. But in the last couple of minutes, we encourage everybody to please log on to FirstCongress.org, www.FirstCongress.org. We actively want your participation. Join in the discussion. Get active in your community. Get active in politics. Become informed. And stand with us as we continue to march towards civility in government, civility in politics, bringing back the civil debate in the public forum. On behalf... Oh, one last thing. Al, if you're listening, you got to get back here, buddy. I can't be a Democrat. I just can't do it, dude. I can't be a Democrat. It's just killing me. Safe travels back, Al. We'll see you next week. on behalf of Perry Blasting, his last show, on behalf of Dr. Ralph Winnie, the Honorable Bob Hines, Congressman Al Swift, I am your moderator, J.T. Russell. This has been Blog Talk Radio's Backroom Politics, live from Shelley's Backroom. We'll see you next week. Same time, same channel.